It's Wednesday, June the 3rd, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. It is about 9 days now since George Floyd died in Minneapolis at the hands of a white policeman. And since then, cities across the United States have seen mass protests and violent clashes sometimes with police forces. A little later, we'll be going to Washington, D.C. to hear the latest on all of that. But first, there have been demonstrations around the world about this issue, and not least in Dublin, actually, where thousands of people participated in a Black Lives Matter march from the city centre to the US Embassy on Monday. To discuss all this, I'm joined by Irish Times reporter Circa Pollock. Hi, Circa.
Hi, Hugh. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Also by Fintan O'Toole. Hello, Fintan.
Hi, Hugh.
And also by Saleh Garnett, also known as Loa. She's a Black musician from Dublin. Hi, Saleh.
Hi.
Circa, I'm going to go to you first because you reported on the march on Monday. I get the impression that the organisers were very surprised by how many people turned out. It was a huge event.
Yeah, it was a huge turnout. And the most striking thing about it was the age demographic. It was young people, I would say, putting the majority between 16 and 25, a lot of teenagers involved. It spread like wildfire, the news of this thing and the plans for it. When I heard about it, it was through a poster, and it appears that most people who were at the event also learned about it through this poster that went across WhatsApp, Twitter, TikTok, all forms of social media. And people gathered at the GPO and walked from the GPO all the way down to the American Embassy in Balls Bridge. And it was, as we remember, Monday was very warm in Dublin. I think it was about 24, 25 degrees. So people in shorts, T-shirts, sun beaming down, and a pretty electric atmosphere. Now, I mean, it should be noted that there have been a lot of complaints in the last few days about the number of people who gathered on the streets, given the restrictions that are currently in place. As I saw it, people were making an effort to stay away from each other as they were walking. I think when people reached the American Embassy, they were kind of on top of each other a bit. But I think the young people involved got caught up, as anyone would, with the atmosphere that was there. It was quite striking, and it was entirely peaceful. It was shouts and chants, but the entire thing was completely peaceful.
Yeah, I think it's important to say, actually a statement landed in my inbox this morning on behalf of the musician Jay Yellowell, who is one of the organisers of the march. Kind of implicit in that was a sense of surprise at the scale it had been, and addressing, I think, to some extent, this question of whether it was appropriate to have that number of people in a gathering. In fact, you know, clearly, by the regulations which we're all currently living under, it isn't. And saying that he, for example, as a result of that, was going to self-isolate for the next 2 weeks, and was advising other people to do the same. Sally, you didn't attend the march because, among other things, you work in the health frontline.
Indeed, yes. It would be irresponsible of me to place myself in a large crowd of people. But of course, I was aware that it was happening. And, you know, it's a complicated thing to gather in large numbers under the restrictions, as you mentioned, Hugh. But also, as Circa did say, it's impossible not to get caught up in the kind of incendiary feeling that's in the world right now, and that desire for justice, and doing anything that we can to support the movement in America.
Can you help me to understand something? And I've seen some people commenting about this on social media. Over the last 3 or 4 years, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in the most abominable circumstances in various situations around the world. One example would be Syria, for example, you know, dreadful human rights abuses. This one appalling incident in Minneapolis, captured on video, flashed around the United States, created this snowball of reaction. Why does that find a purchase so far away in Dublin that other events don't?
It's a really good question. It's one that I've been considering myself. I'm sure a lot of people have. So the Black Lives Matter movement has been in public consciousness for a while. Black/human rights issues that are ongoing in America have been in consciousness for several centuries. Yes, people get very upset and angsty about human rights abuses that happen the world over, post about it, tweet about it for maybe a week or so, and then it goes away and nothing more is done. We don't think about it, we move on. With this issue, I honestly don't have an answer to that. I think that there is an exhaustion that activists feel on the Black Lives Matter issue. I think there's maybe a sense as well that sometimes things just reach a tipping point where you can't keep seeing the same. What's that Einstein quote? If you keep, you can't keep doing the same thing and expecting a different response. There's a kind of a level of insanity at consistently having to see people being brutally murdered in broad daylight and not respond and not do anything. Because at what point does it become incumbent on the population watching it to be at fault? And there's maybe a sense of people finally stepping up and taking responsibility, and certainly white Americans going, it is really and truly on us to actually protect our so-called fellow countrymen. Why Ireland is responding, for black people everywhere, this is extremely triggering. But you have to remember, black people everywhere face racism all the time. So this is not new for us. We're all up to speed on the movement. We're all up to speed on how racism affects our each other in our lives. But this particular incident and the protests that ensue because of the violent nature of George Floyd's death, and then how the protests have taken interesting turns, has been more triggering and has led to black people in Ireland speaking up in a way that we normally don't. So I think what's happening is that because black Irish people are speaking, our fellow Irishmen are going, oh my God, wait, we are not separate from a racist system that allows things like that to happen, albeit America is so extreme in so many ways. Maybe this is triggering us to look at ourselves, because if our black friends are saying, guys, we're not innocent, we're now turning inward, because we can't go over there and, you know, help people per se, but we can certainly do something on our own territory.
Because Black Lives Matter, of course, you know, arose as a movement in response to a very specific situation in the United States where young black men in particular, but not just young black men, but black people in particular, were dying at the hands of white police officers for the most part. And that's what it arose from. That is not a situation that we see in Ireland, but that doesn't mean that a lot of what we're seeing in the United States doesn't have resonance for black Irish people as well. Even that phrase, I can't breathe, has been brought, you know, forward as a sort of metaphor for the experience of black people in Irish society and in other societies.
Yeah. The Black Lives Matter movement is really a phenomenon of social media. I suppose in some ways there's always been a Black Lives Matter movement in some form in America, because activists have been, you know, doing work to get better rights for black people for as long as there have been black people in America, whether it was like slave insurgents and riots or protests. And then, you know, after emancipation, there have been so many movements and there have been so many, you know, riots in response to things. So it's not a new movement per se, but the hashtag is new. The hashtag is recent. That's because now we have phones and now we can record it happening. It's always been there. Now we get to record it. And that's why it becomes harder and harder to ignore and for people to live indifferently when it's coming out of your phone into your sitting room. So in Ireland, I think the sort of mirrored version of that, albeit while it's not necessarily as violent, is in some ways has been going on for generations. I did bring this up in my video that, you know, my mum was born in an institution, like many Irish people, not just mixed race ones, many white people. So we have our own institutionalized major problems that we definitely have swept under the carpet in past generations. So there have been black people here for a long time, coming in and out, not in big numbers, but we've always had interactions. Irish people have traveled all over the world. They've fallen in love with people. They've had their partners come home with them. We've had people come and train as doctors. We've had interactions with black people for generations. Major black activists have actually come to Ireland and tried to lobby here for kind of Irish black unions to support each other, because we have faced such similar types of oppression. But that hasn't always been taken up by the Irish people. I think there are other reasons for that. But we haven't always allied ourselves with our black brothers and sisters, as it were, either in country or out of. So this, the hashtag Black Lives Matter movement and the subsequent outpouring of information that comes as a result of that and historical context is placing Ireland in a really interesting position, because we've never been a colonizer. We've been colonized. We have a lot of things in common with the, those movements. We know what it's like to be brutalized, penalized, face institutional prejudice in your own, on your own territory, in your own land. We know what it's like to be left at the bottom of the barrel in socioeconomic ways in a wider setting. We have so much in common with this. Our problem is that we have, over the generations, we've graduated. I say we, as this is my Irish side speaking now. We, as if I'm a white person, we have graduated to whiteness. And this is how endemic the concept of whiteness is, that we've graduated to believing that we identify more with a random white American who might be a police officer who's going to murder a black person, because the concept of whiteness was created. That's actually relatively new in terms of history. So now we have a problem where Irish people could be the greatest allies on earth for any black rights movement, but have been forced to accept an identity that is whiteness, which separates you from nation or history. Your whiteness allies you more with literally English aristocrats than it does with black people who face similar historical situations. Does that make sense?
I think it does. Vincent, this is a subject that you've written a bit about over the years, about the nature of Irish identity and whiteness, and particularly the way it all worked in the United States in relation to what I think lots of people have referred to as America's original sin, which is the establishment of slavery of African Americans from the more than 400 years ago. Now, do you think we're maybe embarking on a new chapter, whatever that might bring, in that story now?
You know, I'm fascinated by what Sally's saying, you know, and it's and also by the march that's taken place, because I think we might be at a moment actually where we're sort of being forced, as Sally said, in a way, to sort out, you know, our own relationship to racism, you know, and it's a very complex, very involved, very contradictory history that we have. And it's one that we don't really talk about an awful lot. A very simple way of understanding this, right, is to say, who are Irish Americans? You know, was Ella Fitzgerald an Irish American? The name would suggest she was, you know. John Fitzgerald Kennedy is an Irish American. Ella Fitzgerald is not, right? So there are obviously huge numbers of Irish Americans genetically in exactly the same sense as most Irish Americans are, you know, who are African American, right? So blackness trumps Irishness in that sense, right? I remember 20 years ago when I was working in New York, a colleague of mine who was a great African American critic, Stanley Crouch, was asked to give a talk to the Irish American Historical Society, you know, and he was asked to give a talk as an African American, and he introduced himself as an Irish American, you know, to make the point that he had the same kind of genetic history as most of the people present had, and they were very disturbed by it. You know, it was great for him to be African American. It wasn't so good for him to say I'm Irish American. So, you know, it's just an illustration really of how complex and contradictory and difficult our relationship to all of this has been. And we basically got two histories here, right? We have a history, as Sally says, of Irish Americans deciding and you know, being pushed in a direction of racism to say we're better than the blacks because, you know, Irish people were on the same sort of level. And how do you move up the chain? You know, you move up through racism. So, for example, words like miscegenation, very, very powerful word in 19th century America, is invented by an Irish journalist. You know, there's a lot of that stuff, and you know, I won't go on about it. But so you've got this very long history, which is still very present in Trump, right? So it's no accident that Trump has ended up with a very strongly Irish American, Irish Catholic milieu around him, who operate a kind of very differential sense of privilege, right? Which is. And there's a kind of underlying story here, which is we're Irish Americans, we were slaves once, which is complete absolute lie and appalling, you know, misunderstanding of what chattel slavery is, what it's like to be actually owned. But we were slaves once. We came over here. We had nothing. And look at us now. We've succeeded. We're fantastic. The explicit or implicit message is African-Americans, their poverty is their own fault. You know, if they were as good as us, they would be, you know, up where we are. So a deeply racist narrative that's around Irish America. On the other hand, and Sally was referring to this quite rightly, you know, there's another tradition, right? There's the tradition of Daniel O'Connell, you know, who created Irish Catholic consciousness, really, national consciousness in the 19th century, who had a huge opportunity to raise money in the United States and to be a hero in the United States, refusing to set foot in the United States so long as slavery continued to exist. You have O'Connell bringing the great Frederick Douglass for Douglass's first venture outside of the United States as a freed slave. I mean, bringing him, you know, landing in Cove and embracing him as the Black Daniel O'Connell, which in O'Connell's mind was the greatest compliment you could pay to anybody, you know. And you have a very strong anti-racist tradition, which is in America, but also, you know, in Ireland, in the anti-colonial movements. And so we have these two traditions, and we've been able to go along really not having to make sense of them in a way.
Having our cake and eating it, really, being sort of anti-colonial when it suits us and being on the side of the big guys when it suits us as well.
Exactly. So we're great, you know, we're not guilty of racism. At the same time, of course, that sort of the paradoxically this lack of guilt allows people to be very racist, right? Because you don't have to examine your own interactions with people of color. You don't have to think about particularly recent migrants. Maybe this is a moment which is not just an American moment, although it primarily is, but also a moment where, you know, we might examine our own consciences and think a little bit about Irishness and whiteness and all of those kind of things that Sally was so eloquently raising.
Circa, could I ask you about actually two things in relation to that to you? One is that the march itself, a lot of the photographs foregrounded the black participants in the march who were leading the march, rightly so. But Circa, you've also been on social media reporting some of this stuff, and you get a lot of flack and harassment and really abominable abuse. So there's two sides of how this story is developing politically in Ireland, isn't there? There is. There seems to be a grassroots movement supporting what was happening on Monday and protesting against what's happening in the States. But there's also a racist backlash too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there is a very vocal racist backlash online, people who are more than happy to voice their opinions and then hide behind their little Twitter egg. But before I get into that on the protest, what was so heartening about the participation was the diversity within the protest as well. Black, white, brown, it was all races joining together. And it's so reflective of what Ireland is today. I mean, I said it was young people. That is what young people in Ireland is today. I'm not great at numbers when it comes to getting estimates of marches. And I was standing there trying to figure out, and I actually stood on Baggot Street for about 20 minutes watching the march go by, trying to guesstimate what was going on. And I initially admittedly thought it was around 10,000 people. Then I spoke to some photographers and I brought my estimate down to more than 5,000. I still personally think it was around the 8,000 mark. The Gardaí wouldn't give me a number on it because they're no longer giving numbers on protests. But regardless, it was a massive turnout of solidarity. But meanwhile, as you mentioned, online, I've grown quite accustomed in the last few years to getting online abuse. And I'm a white middle class woman. So, I mean, I'm not even at the races when it comes to the kind of stuff black people would be getting. But I do get a lot of hate around immigration because I focus primarily on immigration in my work. I'm accused, one of the more common accusations is I'm accused of leading the white genocide in Ireland and killing off white people. Someone dug up a few years ago and discovered I had a Jewish background. So that's often used as an attack on me. I'm described as a Jew. All of these things, I don't I don't let them get to me. Most of the time I don't read them. But earlier this week, I put out a tweet about the lack of diversity in the Irish media. And the response to that was quite shocking, actually. The level of vitriol around claiming that there should be brown and black faces in the Irish media, saying that's not what Ireland is. Ireland is a white country. The Irish media should be white. I was taken aback by it. And people, I mean, Twitter, we all know about the type of language that can appear on Twitter. I mean, Donald Trump is the perfect example in recent weeks, or I mean years, but also with what happened in the last couple of weeks with Twitter flagging his tweets. But people do feel that they have a license to say whatever it is that they want. And actually, some of them don't even hide behind the Twitter egg anymore. Some of them are openly putting their photo there and will openly engage. And I've noticed, actually, I recently opened in the past year my direct messages on my Twitter so that people could contact me with stories. And in the last few days, I've had a lot of direct emails attacking me with people who want to engage back and forth. This isn't just them sending one message. They want to go back and forth on it. So there is a lot of hatred in this country. Now, having said that, I do think these people are in the minority. I genuinely believe it. I think there's two issues. There is a kind of a latent silent racism that exists among a large proportion of the population who don't believe themselves to be racist, who believe themselves to be very open and very welcoming to people of colour who come here. That in itself is an issue. The Ireland is not racist thing. We are not racist. We are welcoming. That's a huge issue in itself. And as someone pointed out on Twitter the other day, what about the couple who did the Lidl ad and had to leave the country because of the abuse they got online from huge numbers of people? But beside that, there is a small cohort of people who are directly connected to far-right groups and who actively make it their job to go out and attack people like myself or musicians like Loa who do speak out on these issues, and they will actively attack. And this has become almost culturally accepted and a cultural norm that I think 10 years ago people would have been entirely taken aback by.
So I want to get your perspective on that. When Circa tweeted earlier about the lack of diversity in the Irish media, she was absolutely right about that. And I include the Irish Times in that as well. But this country is changing, and it's changing slowly. One of the things that strikes me about this particular event and moment is it reminds us again that, you know, African Americans who've been through these terrible experiences over centuries have also managed to assert their own power and their own voice through cultural channels, through art and literature, and particularly through music. You know, and you're a musician yourself. And when I look around in Ireland now, where I see Black Irish or hear Black Irish voices, it's increasingly evident and loud and impressive in the world of music. But when you listen to what Circa's describing there as a white middle class Irish journalist, what's your experience of the public reaction to you as a public persona in Irish life in the 21st century?
First of all, I would say that this conversation that we're having is probably the first conversation I've ever had in this country in a public space explicitly about race. I know exactly what Circa is talking about because I've experienced that rhetoric in person from people, like in the flesh. So most Black Irish people won't even approach the concept of race in a public space without extreme delicacy, because we know that brimstone and fire that you're talking about. We know it systematically from when we're young. It never comes as a surprise. We know how endemic it is and how much the sliding scale can go from casual indifference to that kind of abuse. And in some cases, even a friend of mine has received like very threatening messages about her personal safety, who's a Black artist who's visible. So unfortunately, that doesn't surprise me. And as a result, in some ways, it's sad to say that I haven't really approached this conversation before because I'm afraid. I don't feel capable of handling that a lot of the time. It's very traumatic, as I'm sure, Circa, you know this at this point. You know, unfortunately, you get used to it. But because my role that is a musician, I like to keep the conversation around music. And I feel like as you just said to you, what African Americans who work in the arts have taught us is that you can actually say a lot by saying not as much as you you might want to say. You know, you can make very clear points in poems, in songs, which can be taken up at people's leisure. When you start coming out with very clear, specific requests, directives, demands, as you say, even circa a white middle class person, suddenly you are now, you're on the black side, and you're getting all of that vitriol and hate that's been pent up for centuries towards black people. Ah, you're with them. Okay, here's the brimstone of fire. Now, we know that. I see that down the pub all the time. That's not news to me. I know that guy, I know that girl, you know. I've had friends who we even went to college with who've had to literally jump in situations at festivals, for example, where there's alcohol taken and people can't hold themselves in as much as usual. So I think a lot of black people who have this cultural sensitivity are born with that sensitivity and desire to affect change, or are expressive, or expressiveness, will gravitate towards the arts sooner than they will activism, because activism makes you very vulnerable in a place where you're already very vulnerable. So you're vulnerable from the get-go. So to then, you have to have a real fire under you and a real determination. Now, that's actually, I've come to feel that that's a little bit of an excuse on our part as well. And I do think that especially people like me who are black and also privileged have more of an onus on us to not just kind of cower and to speak up. Now, that not to say that I'm going to make a habit out of it, because fundamentally I am still a musician and I probably won't be doing too many more conversations like this. I just really wanted to speak to you guys. But I think that we need to definitely support black activists and people who are, you know, taking that risk. Because as Sirik has described, it is that when you put yourself out there, you really see the face of the public, and that it's a many headed demon / god, whatever way you want to look at it. Yeah. So
do you have a sense, finally, if you wouldn't mind, that we're going in the right direction? That when Barack Obama said the arc of history bends towards progress, ultimately, that despite setbacks and two steps forward, one steps back, that we're going in the right direction.
Yeah, Hugh, I could not agree more with that statement. Obviously there's so much triggering happening all the time, there's a lot of painful views being come about. I'm also overwhelmed by the sheer numbers of people who are willing to even engage with the fact that if you align yourself as white, which is a concept, that you are unintentionally aligning yourself with racism and you didn't even know. It's like you've had a software program downloaded into your brain that you never gave permissions for. And I think the willingness of Irish people, who actually at our center, there is a humility and a compassion that you get from pain, that you get from centuries of knowing pain, that is there to be woken up. And people, we have rested on our laurels. We have an institutionalized major problem in direct provision. We have real examples in every black person's life, can tell you of plenty of examples, even people, friends, loved ones, partners who speak from that software program. But there is a willingness to unpack, as you said, Fintan, that we're at this crossroads now where we're like, hang on, you know, we've been having our cake and eating it. Which side of this fence are we on? Are we for progress, or are we just happy to leave things the way they are, which means turning a blind eye to literal slaughter? And I think as a nation, we have it in us to do better, because we want to do better, and we know what that's like, and we want a different version of a reality. It's going to be challenging and it's going to be really uncomfortable, because that first period of accepting that you've been part of a problem is always so painful. You know, even I know that I have also taken in those racist ideas, used them against myself in forms of self-harm, either mental, emotional, otherwise. I've even used them to traumatize other black people, because I was acting from the mouthpiece of a concepts that were invented centuries ago to allow exploitation. So I know exactly what this process is, because I've had to do it, because I didn't want to keep going on hating myself. And now that we're all waking up as a nation, and we're doing a lot of waking up in the past few generations, and it's great, and more of it.
Saleh, Sirika, listen, thanks very much for joining us. Stick with us. Fintan is going to stick with us, and in a moment we'll be joined from Washington by Suzanne Lynch.
You're listening to the Irish Times.
Suzanne, you're back in Washington. You were in Atlanta for a couple of days, so you've seen these events unfold in two different major American cities. Things calmed down slightly last night, did they?
I think they did. I was back here on Tuesday night for the protest. I'd been there for the first night on Friday also. And look, it's difficult to characterise things when you're one reporter in the midst of thousands of people. And there were demonstrations taking place across Washington, not just outside the White House, but also beneath the Lincoln Memorial and at Capitol Hill. But absolutely, the atmosphere and the feeling was one of peaceful demonstration. It was one of passion and of emotion, and there was a real sense that people felt very strongly about this. And there's a lot of chanting that was happening sporadically throughout these hours that people stood there. But I saw no violence. There was tension, but no violence as such. And I think there was a shift in the attitude of the law and order of the authorities in the 24 hours after Monday night's events, when the police moved to disperse protesters before the 7 p.m. curfew happened, and which facilitated the photo op whereby Donald Trump left the White House, walked through the gates and went and stood in front of a church. Yesterday, when I was down at that church, there were, at one point, I was looking at these members of the clergy with their collars, a man and a woman chatting to these young African-American men who'd gathered there. People were sitting on the rails. It's like they had reclaimed this symbol. The atmosphere, as I said, was charged, but very peaceful. I was there past a curfew but it kept going really until after midnight, but much, much fewer people. And then shortly before 1 a.m, the police, there were a few skirmishes, very, very small level compared to the previous night, and then it seemed to have dispersed. So I think this was, one would say, a victory of sorts for demonstrators who were able to stand out there, protest peacefully the right that's enshrined in the First Amendment of the Constitution, which Americans always cite, without and getting moved on from the police. So I think a lot of the protesters that I met last night would be very happy with how things progressed as the night went on.
And then more broadly, you know, across the United States, is there similar things happening? And I wonder as well, as listening to you there, obviously a lot of this is down to what's happening with the demonstrators themselves, but there's also what the police are doing, and you know, the various police forces are not a monolith themselves either, and they may be pursuing different strategies. There was clearly a call from the right and from Trump for an expression of dominance, I think was the phrase that he used. It's essentially a more violent crackdown. But on the other hand, I was looking at footage of police officers, you know, deliberately stepping forward and taking the knee to kind of indicate some level of solidarity with the demonstrators too. So different kinds of approaches.
Yeah, and I think it's important again to highlight the fact that runs through so much of American life, which is the distinction between the federal government and states. And like so many parts of American life, individual states and the governors who run those states have a huge amount of power, as they do with law and order. So what happened in D.C., and that's one of the reasons why it was so interesting on Monday night when things kicked off, was that D.C. is not a District of Columbia. It's not actually a state. The mayor has the jurisdiction, and yet there are lots of federal buildings within D.C. So it's a kind of a mismatch of authority. And that's one of the reasons why Donald Trump and his cabinet, it looks like Attorney General Bill Barr, ordered the square in front of the White House to be cleared. They have quite a lot of power around that area of Washington. But look, it comes down to individual states, how they run their law enforcement. And yes, you're absolutely right. We saw different styles. We saw different levels and we saw individual cases. I was in Atlanta. That was definitely, the scenes I saw there were definitely more tense. There was a standoff between a line of police and a line of protesters who were screaming at them, throwing the odd water bottle. It didn't really kick off into any further violence from that, but there was at least pepper spray sprayed, maybe tear gas, I'm not sure. But there you saw the police in full riot gear, and also the National Guard, which was called up. Each state has a National Guard. They were patrolling also. So there was a forcible display of power and of law and authority there. What was one of the most moving moments for me was at one point in Atlanta, a young woman who was had huge signs, and she was shouting over at the National Guard. And from what I could hear, she seemed to be saying, you know, you're black, so am I. Why are you standing on that side? So I felt, you know, for African-American members of the police force, I think this is particularly difficult. This has been characterised as a fight between a white-only police force that has cases of institutional racism built into its DNA, whereas in fact a lot of these police officers I've seen and National Guard members are from all ethnic backgrounds, all races. So I think, you know, it's just a poignant, it's an emotional moment for America. That's been played out in these cities around the country. And of course, Hugh, I'm talking about two of the major cities with big African-American populations, Washington, D.C. and Atlanta. There were protests in smaller cities. I was around Georgia. There were four protests in Augusta, Georgia over the last 4 years. There was protest in Savannah. They were all peaceful. And so we've seen the smaller towns and cities across America also wake up and hold some of the biggest movements of mass protest in generations. But all mostly peaceful.
Fintan, I have to ask you about Trump. He's a man who wears his id on the outside, or in his tweets. That a lot of people have compared what's been happening to what was happening in the 1960s when the cities of the United States went up in flames and Martin Luther King was assassinated, and there was this kind of climax of tension and violence in 1968, and Richard Nixon very cannily took political advantage of that and won the election, and on the back of an appeal to what he called the silent majority, which many people read as being the white majority. Trump, of course, tweeted in all caps, silent majority, exclamation mark. So it's not very subtle that he's looking to try and do his own garbled version of that. But do you think that could succeed?
It could, you know, that's absolutely the gamble that he's taking, you know, which is following his gut instinct, which, you know, is hugely problematic, but has got him so far. And that instinct is that, indeed, if he can succeed in the narrative of characterizing the protesters as anti-fa, you know, which he's become obsessed with, anarchists, looters, thugs, and I am the law and order president, you know, I stand for the silent majority. Interestingly, also, even within black communities, I mean, we'll be trying kind of a narrative, which is the Democrats are weak, you know, black businesses being completely destroyed. So there's a kind of a narrative there which in theory could transcend the racial divide. Okay, now, very much in theory, I say, but that's the way he's trying to frame it. I think his difficulty is that he's not Nixon, right? So people, I mean, Trump is late Nixon, right? Trump is the mad, deranged, unmoored Nixon of the Watergate years, you know, who has lost any sense of a connection between what's going on in the White House and the reality of what's going on outside. 1968 Nixon is a very smart politician, right? Who is saying the silent majority wants unity. The silent majority wants peace. The silent majority wants somebody who can bring America together. So yes, he's doing a sort of, you know, there are these thugs out there, there are these bad people, but he's also doing, you know, I am the one who can bring everybody together. Now, historically, that might seem laughable, but it's very powerful in 1968, right? And that's the big difference, right, is that Trump, unlike Nixon, unlike almost any other kind of conventional right-wing politician in these circumstances, is completely unable and unwilling to even attempt a rhetoric of unification and healing. Right. He just doesn't do that. And I think that's his problem, right, which is Trump's mindset is crude and binary. Right? And he set it out for the governors in that sort of leaked call that he did, you know, kind of communal phone call with the governors. And you mentioned it, where he used this thing about domination. But what he basically said was, you're either dominant or you're a jerk. Right. you're acting like jerks, you got to go out and show dominance. And now there's only two states you can be in, right? And I think Trump's problem is that most people understand that the domination, to be against domination, if domination takes the form of murdering black people on the streets slowly on camera, maybe it's not a kind of domination that for the sort of middle ground America they actually want to see. And Trump's rhetoric of, you know, trying to basically frame this as a war. I mean, a lot of us have been speculating for the last couple of years about when is Trump going to do a war? Well, this is now, right? This is what he's trying to do. This is my war. Of course, maybe we were all wrong thinking that it would be an external war. He's much more interested in the internal one. But that war rhetoric, that sort of binary mentality of dividing people into those who don't support domination are just jerks. I think it solidifies his own base. Absolutely. The racism appeals to his base. Trump is a racist. Trump's public persona as a political figure is absolutely based on racism. It's based on his first big campaign was against the kids who had been wrongly accused of the horrific Central Park rape. That was a, you know, huge public profile for him, for the death penalty to be applied to them. His second big campaign, remember, was the racist campaign, the birther conspiracy, that Obama couldn't possibly be American. You know, the implication, not particularly subtle, being that, of course, because he was black. So Trump is a racist, and he people have voted for him knowing that he's a racist. And so undoubtedly, the implicit racism of his characterization of the protests will solidify those people who voted for him. His problem is that it may also animate a lot more African-American voters to come out and vote in November. And I would have thought, Suzanne would have a better sense of this than I would, but I would have thought it very much risks alienating a sort of middle ground because it has no rhetoric of unification.
Isn't that exactly it, Suzanne? And it's interesting. I mean, Joe Biden gave what I thought was probably the most impressive speech of his presidential campaign this year so far this week. It still wasn't brilliant, but it was certainly better than a lot of what has come before. And it was clearly appealing to that middle ground, which Fintan is talking about. You can imagine those suburban middle-class women who peeled away from the Republicans in the congressional elections a couple of years ago, sticking with the Democrats on the basis of that. And then the other part of it is to animate the base, and in a way the base is animated by Trump's very existence, but perhaps you look to cement that by having an African-American woman as his running mate.
Yeah, I think Trump is taking a gamble here. He is rolling the dice and hoping that, as Fintan explained, this rhetoric of division, of claiming he is the president of law and order, is going to work for him and it's going to win him the election. The problem is that Donald Trump has always ruled as they say, a 42% president. He has made no attempt to kind of broaden his support base. Instead, he has spoken only to that core group that voted for him. I'm in no doubt that core group of Republicans who voted for Donald Trump are still going to support him. His problem now, though, is that he is really, really alienating huge portions of society. And those two parts of society, A, the African-American vote, the non-white vote, and B, the moderate suburban voters, most of them women. For example, we'll take a couple of cities. I was in Atlanta, say Dallas, or Houston or Detroit. Those cities, the suburbs around those cities, where there are thousands and thousands of people, that was traditionally Republican ground, moderate Republicans. I know some people here, you know, women in their 40s, whose instinct would to vote Republican in a kind of economic way, you know, low taxes. These are the kind of people who are turning in droves against Donald Trump. They do not like what they see from him. And I think Republicans are now worried that the damage he is doing to the brand, yes, it's of Republicanism. Yes, he's going to motivate his base. They're going to turn out. But I think lots of people in this country are going to vote for Biden. Now, then it comes down to maths, the Electoral College. You won't get into all that now. I mean, Donald Trump got lucky last time around. He won some of these key swing states, some by a tiny margin. Michigan is a state of 10 million people. He won it by 10,000 votes. There was a massive anti-Hillary Clinton issue, I think, in the last election as well. So when you look at those figures, it's not looking good for Donald Trump. As for at the moment, I mean, things can change, and I don't want to really get into the business prediction. As for Joe Biden, you're absolutely right, Hugh, that the speech was good. This is where Biden excels. Now, there is a caveat here. He's got his own issues around race. Obviously, Kamala Harris attacked him for his previous positions on busing in the first Democratic debate over about a year ago. And secondly, his comments in the last few weeks where he said, "You ain't black," to a well-known African-American radio presenter, really went down badly. In saying that, though, we all know the problems with Joe Biden's candidacy, but where he excels is this idea of I'm the figure of unity, I've got compassion, I've got empathy, and also thrown in, I've got experience, I know where the light switches are in the White House, as somebody said to me. People want that at the moment, I think. They just want someone who can steady the ship. So these kind of societal divisions, I think, play to Joe Biden's strengths. Look, he's still got a lot of issues, and anything could happen in the next 5 months. He really is prone to gaffes, for example. But his people, I think, are purposely keeping away from the limelight, and it's worked out for him now. He was able to give this big set piece speech in Philadelphia, which incidentally is near Delaware, where he's been living, his home. He was able to go out, do that. And in Philadelphia, a city with a huge African-American population. And again, in a swing state, Pennsylvania, where, I mean, I think the Republicans are very worried about winning that state. They did very badly in the midterm elections. So, yeah, I think this is going to play to Joe Biden's strengths. And I think Republicans are going to be quite worried about how this ultimately plays in the polls in November.
Fintan, I wonder, a listener to the podcast sent me, Paul Krugman, the New York Times economist, sends a newsletter out every day. And he was writing about how, it's a cliche to say it, but it still doesn't make it untrue, the original defining sin of America and the United States is race, slavery, Jim Crow, racism. It actually goes to explain a lot of the huge problems around things like violence, vast prison populations, the absence of a health service. One of the reasons why that wasn't instituted was because of a fear of mingling of the races. All those kinds of things. And all those forces have tended usually to benefit the right when it plays on the fears which they arouse. Is it possible maybe that this time, what Suzanne describes, that the sheer chaos and misrule of Trump and Trumpism might end up benefiting the Democrats in this case?
I have a feeling it will. You see, Trump's problem is that he's very, very good at animating his own base, but he doesn't need to animate his own base. You know, he has the most loyal, solid, unchanging, unshifting political base that we've seen anywhere in the modern world, right? You know, he famously said that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't make any difference. And I think that's actually literally true. I think he could. You know, particularly if it was a black person, it'd be great, you know, or a liberal, you know. I mean, so his base is bought into the Trump brand. And it's very like Brexit. You know, people have voted for it and they don't want to be made to feel that they were stupid or that they were wrong. They get pleasure from the fact that other people hate them for what they've done. It's this kind of feedback loop that they're in, and they're not going to change. So Trump's problem is that his great instinct is at feeding red meat to that base. But, you know, they're up to their neck in red meat. They don't really need any more. The larger story that Trump was telling, right, was American carnage. That's, you know, his phrase. And the paradox, of course, is that he's managed to create the very thing that he evoked. There was no American carnage. You know, he's created it. Any objective persons, you know, or anybody who's not sort of completely fired up as part of Trump's base can just look at their country and realize that it has a catastrophic record in terms of the coronavirus plague, which is 90% down to Trump. I think objective estimates suggest that at least 60 to 70,000 people have died unnecessarily because of Trump's failures of policy and management. You have now, of course, the economic chaos that's going to, well, is already unfolding and is going to continue. And now on top of this, you have these images of disorder, of chaos. And even the sort of law and order thing is double-edged, isn't it? Right. So to say I'm the law and order president, well, it's great if you're in opposition, right? So what Nixon could do in 68, for example, was he wasn't in power, right? So he can say, if I were in power, you know, these anarchists wouldn't be getting away with it. Trump's been in power. He will have been in power, you know, for nearly 4 years by the time the November election comes around. So I think the carnage thing begins to work against Trump. So the very powerful thing. And just say, well, have you made America great again? Does this look great to anybody at any level? You know, where are the successes? Where's the great story of American Renaissance? So I do agree with Suzanne in the sense that I think this plays well for Biden. Biden is still a very, very problematic and weak candidate. The saving grace for the Democrats is that the Democratic candidate is Donald Trump. And I think everything that's happening is likely to feed into the key thing, which is turnout. Turnout's always been the issue, you know, and if people who are inclined to vote Democratic actually turn out at the ballot box, then the Democrats win. I hope the Democrats are sensible enough to keep Biden under wraps in a way that coronavirus has been very good because it's kept him isolated. The less, you know, Biden just needs to be doing set pieces which are very controlled, very direct, very simple, and let Trump be Trump. Let Trump be the candidate. I mean, Biden's power is that he's not Trump. And if they stick with that, if he gets a good vice presidential candidate who's presumably going to be an African-American woman, and there are some outstanding women that he could choose from, then you have to think the odds favor him. But as Trump slips, as he panics, it's going to get nastier and nastier and nastier.
Finally, Suzanne, I imagine the entire Washington press corps are absolutely terrified of making any predictions given the way that American politics has gone over the last 3 or 4 years. So how do you think it's all going to go?
Oh, no, I hate this question, Hugh. I'm going to say it, though. I think Biden's going to win in November. For some of the reasons I just explained, I think Trump got lucky the last time he won a series of swing states. I think the Hillary Clinton candidacy was a disaster for Democrats. She's very unpopular in this country. That is a reality among a lot of people. I think this is the main point, that we are now in a world where Donald Trump has been in charge for nearly 4 years. People voted the last time not knowing, not expecting Donald Trump to be in power. Now he is in power, and a lot of Democrats were complacent last time around. So they will vote, they will vote for anyone who put the Democrats put up, I think. So really, you know, the bar has been lowered phenomenally in American politics following the election of Donald Trump. So I think Joe Biden at the moment, particularly if he picks an African-American woman like a Kamala Harris, I think he's going to win. There will be difficulties for Democrats in some states. I think Florida is very difficult. It's a hugely important state with a lot of Electoral College votes. Republicans could do very well there. You know, but states like Michigan and Pennsylvania, I think they'll go Democrat. I can't believe I'm making all these predictions now. I should probably stop you before I go into every state and you'll be playing this back in a few months. But look, I do. I think Democrats are in a good place at the moment. And just to pick up finally on what Fintan there said, turnout is key. And this has got racial aspects to it, too. One of the big issues here is the underrepresentation of African-Americans on the voter register, instances of gerrymandering around this country that have gone right up to the Supreme Court. Down in Georgia, again, where I've been for the last few days, huge work being done on that. Stacey Abrams, who's been named as a possible running mate for Joe Biden, this is her life work. She is trying to increase voter access for African Americans. The Republicans are petrified about this. This is why you had Donald Trump going on again and again about postal voting and claiming erroneously that this would lead to fraud. They're terrified that the more people who get on the election register, the more people who vote by mail will vote for Democrats. So I think both parties are aware of what's to play for here when it comes to the issue of voter representation, the electoral register, and how many people actually get out and vote on November 3rd.
All right, we shall leave it there. Thanks very much to Suzanne and to Fintan. Also, to Sally and to Circa for joining us earlier. Thanks also to our producer, Declan Conlon. And if you would like to support this podcast and indeed the Irish Times, all you have to do is go to irishtimes.com/subscribe, where you can sign up for the introductory price of €1 for the first month. And if you want to get in touch with us, we'd be really delighted to hear from you. Just email us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Until the next time, though, thanks very much indeed for listening.